Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. This week, we have a special guest who's going to be talking about one of the most important topics in law enforcement, PTSD and stress-related issues involving law enforcement. Before we get to her, let's take a walk into the briefing room where I will give you my view from the blue.
The Briefing Room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
I received a very troubling message over Facebook a couple days ago. It was from a young police officer in a East Coast police department. And he told me, "Randy, I've been following your page for quite a while. I respect what you do. My partner committed suicide yesterday, and I'm having trouble dealing with it. He began having some alcohol issues, got in trouble at work, and committed suicide. Would you please talk about that on your show and on your page? I'm going to honor that request because this is one of the most essential subjects to be talked about in policing. I myself, of course, have had the terrible, painful duty of responding to police officers who have committed suicide. I've talked to their widows. I've seen the carnage and the damage that it leaves behind. And many times it is absolutely so senseless that it's heartbreaking. When that young police officer told me that his partner had gotten in trouble prior to committing suicide, that brought back a very important statistic that every law enforcement officer should know. And that is, a law enforcement officer is 7 times more likely to commit suicide when they have gotten in trouble on duty or off duty, whether they are facing charges, either criminal or administrative. That's the unfortunate reality. There is help. There are so many stresses involved with law enforcement, which is why the guest that I have on for this interview is so topical and so timely. There is help. SafeCallNow.org is one of the organizations that helps law enforcement officers with depression and addiction problems. The organization that Susan Simmons, Under the Shield, is another one. And there are many, many others. And there is help within your own agencies. There is help in your own communities. You just mustn't be afraid to seek it. That's one of the most important things that I could ever talk about. All of us have had bouts of depression, especially in law enforcement, when you are fed a constant diet of pain and cruelty and misery, and you observe what man is capable of doing to another human being. It cannot help but to affect you emotionally and mentally. There's no shame in looking for help. There's no shame in finding someone to talk to that is either a professional, someone who has experience in PTSD and also in police-related stress, or even just a close friend, someone that understands. One thing that police officers don't do very well is share. I know that. I've been there. I've been at that point. And that's why I can tell you from experience and from my heart that if you feel that depression, if you feel that hopelessness, reach out. If to no one else, reach out to me. We will talk. And that is my view from the blue.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. It's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. We invite you back to AmericaOutLoud.com to get all the latest. Make it a daily stop and also get the app. You go right to the App Store and download our free app, and that will put all our content right into your hands on your phones and your tablets. It doesn't get any easier than that.
Welcome to the interview room on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I have a great guest with me today. Her name is Susan Simmons, and she is the president and founder of Under the Shield. I often talk about the mental health and emotional health of American law enforcement officers and how difficult it is to retain that balance and to get the help that is so often needed. And Susan, that's what she does. And I'd like to welcome her to the show. Thanks for coming on, Susan.
Thank you, Randy, so much for having me. It's an honor to be here and being interviewed by you.
Well, let's talk about, first of all, tell us a little bit about why you created Under the Shield.
Back in 1992, I was married to a federal agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration, and we had an agent killed in Alabama, and his wife found out about his death on the news. I was a litigation paralegal at the time, and that just did not sit well with me. This was a fairly new agent, and the reality of the situation is that possibility is even greater now with Facebook, Twitter, everything. Information just gets out before to the general public before families can even be notified. So I went back to school, got my master's in counseling and human development, and completed that program, and then realized the need for anonymity and confidentiality. So what we do at Under the Shield is we provide what's called stress coaching. The majority of our coaches have master's and PhDs, but all of them have some level of experience in what we call the lifestyle. This is a 24/7, 365 profession that the families are thrown into it. And so we believe that you have to have life experience in this. And so what we've done is we have created a program that we do not have licensed individuals by choice. So we're not mandatory reporters. So people can call us, text us, email us, Skype us, whatever they want to do, private messages on Facebook, and we're not required to keep any kind of notes or records. We don't even have to have their name.
Gotcha. So it is completely anonymous.
Absolutely. And that will always be a requirement of Under the Shield. We also do something and that's a pretty unique program. We can't find anything else like it in the country. Usually there's a mandatory reporter, a licensed person supervising or somewhere in the program. But that is not anything we will ever have at Under the Shield. It does not mean that we can't refer people if they request it. If for some reason they feel like they need testing, medication, whatever, we can certainly refer them. But 99% of the time, we're able to handle the situations just through the stress coaches. The other thing that we do is we offer resiliency training, and we include the spouses, parents, significant others, adult siblings to come in along with the law enforcement officer so that they can also learn kind of some unique stuff about the lifestyle.
Okay. Now, how do people get referred to you?
Right now, we've been in business for so long. A lot of it is word of mouth and Facebook, believe it or not. We get a lot off of there. And then, of course, when I do the trainings, I'm headed to Denver this weekend for one. And in the trainings, I talk about it a lot. I give out the contact information. So there's a lot of ways they can find out about us.
All right. Let's go to the training aspect for a moment.
Sure.
Who is it that who do you actually train? Is it police agencies? Is it police groups?
It can be done one of a lot of ways. We've actually had some wives groups that have contacted us about bringing us in since the Dallas tragedy and Baton Rouge. Spouses are kind of stepping up and providing this type training as well because they're very interested in it. It can come through FOPs, police associations, police agencies. I've taught for the FBI at Quantico. I've taught for SWAT organizations like SWAT Roundup in Orlando, Florida. I've taught for narcotics associations all over the country. And I've gone into the agencies as well. I was just down with Pueblo, Colorado Police Department, and their county agency brought me in a few weeks ago. And we did several trainings down there for them.
Okay, if I were a police association and I brought you in for a quote training, unquote, what is it that you would actually train us on?
It's called Warrior Survival at Home and on the Streets.
And I like that name. That's a good name.
I kind of thought you might. We call it emptying the psychological garbage can. We talk about stress. And one of the interesting things that the guys are always telling me that they get from the class is we actually go through all the different definitions of stress, cultural, medical, scientific. And one of the first questions I even ask them before we start looking at definitions is stress positive or negative? And the answer is yes, because it's both.
Right.
Especially in this industry. And as we go through all these different dictionary definitions, we begin to see the pattern that there's very little, if anything, positive in the definitions. So about 15 years ago, I realized this was a problem. I taught for an agency, and they all agreed they had stress, but when I asked them what it was, they didn't have a clue. So we kind of changed the definition at Under the Shield, and the way we define it, stress is change. Stressors are the activating event that bring about the change. And the key to all of it is your stress reaction is based on your perception about the change. So that allows for something that's positive for you could be negative for me and vice versa.
I understand. I understand what you're saying. It's similar to there is a such thing as we always hear about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. But we rarely hear about post-traumatic stress growth. And that is, in fact, a reality as well.
Yes. And I'm not a big believer in post-traumatic stress disorder until there's traumatic brain injury added to it. I teach with Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. I think you're familiar with the Colonel.
Absolutely.
And we've been teaching together, been friends for 15 years. And as Dave puts it, Susan's training is the rest of the story. And he and I are we're on the same page with this. We think it's way overdiagnosed. And a lot of times I think they add the disorder to it because, first of all, it keeps a lot of mental health people employed.
Right.
And it keeps the pharmaceutical industry in business.
Yeah, I agree. I understand exactly what you're saying. And when you label something a disorder, mm-hmm. it has a lot of ramifications that we had not anticipated as law enforcement officers, including actually playing a role in terminations of police
yes.
officers.
And, you know, I was teaching Border Patrol a few months back down in Yuma, and one of the agents and I were having this conversation, and he was a little offended at first at the way I was talking about post-traumatic stress. And here's how I explained it to him, because I asked him, I said, "You're working, correct?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "And you're good at your job?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "I'm sure you probably have some nightmares every now and then, that kind of stuff." And he says, "I do." And I said, "Well, you're obviously working through them." And I equate it to the same thing as chicken pox and shingles. You know, you can have chicken pox and you may or may not have shingles, but it's in your system. They may not actually come full blown. But the reality is you never get rid of the chicken pox, but you live with it. And the same thing happens with post-traumatic stress. And I think we're making people victims by labeling it as a disorder, which implies permanent.
Yes, yes, yes. I agree.
And I just refuse to let these guys that are these warriors, that the reality is the reason for so many of the negative issues with post-traumatic stress is, for example, with our military. We work with the military also. We train them to go overseas. I have a son who's a Marine. He was trained to deploy to the desert. But the reality is we forgot to train them how to come home.
Yeah.
And with law enforcement, still in so many academies around this country, they are trying to teach these young officers to keep personal and professional separate. You can't do it. It's an impossible task. They have to come home and at least be able to talk about the things that bother them, maybe not in great detail. But I can remember in my own situation when mine would come home and I didn't have a clue what his day was and he's in a bad mood, I assumed I had done something wrong. The children assumed they had done something wrong. When in reality, it was something he might have been exposed to children the ages of our kids in a meth lab that day. That was something that always bothered him. And we haven't trained families what to look for or how to interact. And that's the question we're getting a lot right now on Facebook is, how do I help my law enforcement spouse without being the devil's advocate?
Right.
Because we haven't taught them how to do this.
Yes. No, I couldn't agree more. I have probably had thousands of conversations over the years with different police officers, And they, every one of them has a different philosophy of the things that they want to share. Mm-hmm. Many want to shield their loved ones from the ugliness of what they face each day. So they see it as protecting their family, when in reality what it's doing is it's shutting them off.
That's right. It's admirable what they're trying to do. And that's one of the things that I teach them. This is admirable, but you're isolating your family. And then we talk about the psychological garbage can. And we talk about it in the manner of, I give them the analogy, if you don't empty your garbage at home for a long period of time, what's the first thing you notice?
It starts stinking.
Yes. When your psychological garbage can, some of the early warning signs are you're irritable, you're cynical, you're snapping at your family. They're saying things to you like you're not as much fun as you used to be. You've got that sick sense of humor because they don't understand that that's healthy.
Right.
And then we talk about when you finally go to pick up the garbage at home and empty it, it's got maggots in it and all kind of stuff growing in it, and you pick it up and the bag breaks. Now you're angry. Blood pressure rises. Heartburn turns to acid reflux. We know for a fact stress causes cancer, diabetes, asthma, all of these things. And we believe that that's because we haven't taught people how to empty their psychological garbage can.
And how does one do that?
Well, there are a lot of ways. First of all, we also teach the brain controls the body, but how the body feels impacts what the brain thinks. If you're sleep deprived, if you're vitamin deprived, if you're hungry, if you're cold, whatever's going on is going to impact the brain, then the brain goes even more negative, and now that feeds negative signals to the body. The very first thing that we always start with at Under the Shield, when we're dealing with someone either individually or in training, I talk to them about the importance of being physiologically in balance. One of the very first things, and let me give you these symptoms. How long have you been retired?
6 years.
Okay. Tell me how many of these symptoms you had or have. Mild depression, loss of energy, irritability, sleep pattern changes, eating pattern changes, and inability to concentrate.
At one time or another, I probably had all of them.
Do you know what those are the symptoms of?
Let me guess.
Please do.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Actually, no. They are the symptoms of vitamin B, as in Bravo, deficiency.
Really? That's interesting.
I spent 5 weeks with the NYPD post 9/11, and this was probably some of the most valuable information that these guys got from me. And that was to begin to take large doses of vitamin B complex. But you have to make sure it's a healthy one. There's a lot of synthetics out there. And so we have several that we recommend. They're on our website. It's not anything that you get through us. This isn't a moneymaker for us. But you need to make sure you're getting a B12 in the B complex called methylcobalamin, because the synthetic is made from cyanocobalamin, and it's small doses, but it converts to cyanide in your system.
No, that doesn't sound like any fun.
Well, exactly. And it can drop your immune system. So we're just bigger on giving really good, natural, healthy products if you're going to do this. But if you go to your doctor with those symptoms, what are they more than likely going to give you?
They're going to give you antidepressants.
Absolutely. And they're probably going to give you Ambien to help you sleep,
right,
which is the worst drug ever manufactured. I'm proud to say that it took 10 years, but the FBI director just recently in the last few months came out with a direct order that says that no FBI agent is allowed to have any therapeutic level of Ambien in their system.
Well, that makes a great deal of sense, because I was on it for about 3 years. As when I was a graveyard watch graveyard lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
and I almost set my house on fire 3 times.
I bet you did a lot of things you didn't know that you were doing. And the funny part is, officers will look at me and go, "I take that stuff and I'm fine." And I go, "How do you know what you forgot?"
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, it was destructive. I realized it when I weaned myself off of it, that it really did have a negative effect on me.
Well, it's artificial. It's sedated sleep. It will never be healthy sleep for you. Your eyes may be closed and the time may go by, but your body's not getting the restorative effects that it needs from sleep. And you can die from sleep deprivation. We've had officers who've actually died from it, and that's what the autopsy showed. So we give them all natural ways, and there's so many. And these are just kind of the beginning steps of emptying the garbage can by making sure you're healthy. Then calling us or calling a peer support team, those are the kinds of people that they usually feel safer emptying their garbage to without the fear of, am I going to traumatize my family with this?
Right.
But they have to explain to their families the things that are going on with them and why they're going on, that it has nothing to do with the family. It has to do with things they're seeing and exposed to, frustrations, supervisors, whatever. And these are the ways to keep that garbage down. And I believe this is why law enforcement is high in suicide.
I agree with you. And you just touched on something I want to go into with a little more depth. Talking about police supervisors and police leadership.
Yes.
One of the things that I have heard universally is that leadership and supervision plays an absolutely dramatic role in the emotional well-being of law enforcement officers. And it's something that is not at the forefront of the conversation, and it should be.
Absolutely. I use the example, and it was funny because one of the supervisors came up to me after the class and said, that was brilliant. But the very first thing I ask in the classes, and a lot of times these guys don't know me from anybody, and I'll ask the question, how many of you went to an academy and were issued a gun? And they're kind of looking around at each other like, are we in the right classroom? And they'll start raising their hands. And then I say, how many of you were taught how to properly clean and maintain that weapon? And eventually hands go up. And I finally asked one day, and I said, why did you have to be taught how to maintain and clean your weapon? And he said, because if we don't, it will malfunction or misfire. And I said, well, here's my question for all of you. Then why are we teaching you to take better care of your equipment than we are of yourselves? And I had a supervisor get up and walk out of the class, and I thought, I'm in trouble. And he came back later and he said, that was brilliant. And he said, we want you. We've got you in our budget now for at least twice a year.
That's awesome. That's great. You know, one of the things that I find when I address police leaders, mm-hmm. And I bring up a topic that is very sensitive, but it touches on the things that we're talking about, because when you have what I call administrative corruption within a police agency, it dramatically affects the mental health and the emotional well-being of those officers. Now, when I talk about administrative corruption, mm-hmm. what I'm talking about is when a police leader, whether it is a supervisor or an actual chief or someone in the administration, uses their power for personal reasons as opposed to just to because of the agency's rules and regulations. That is, you know, many of these, out of the 18,000 police agencies in the country, 80% of them have less than 20 police officers.
Right.
So there's long-standing relationships that take place within these agencies, and of course we're not friends with everybody that we work with.
Right.
But when a police leader misuses their authority in order to settle personal scores, mm-hmm. this happens all over the country.
Yes, it does.
And it's never talked about.
And it's killing morale. And we've got enough killing morale outside the department. We sure as heck don't need it in the department.
Is this something that you address in your training?
I do.
Perhaps not using that strong a term of administrative corruption, but the effect that administrators and supervisors have on their officers?
I do, and I actually was teaching a class, this has been years ago, to command staff. And I had a chief make the mistake of asking me what was causing the morale issue in his agency. And I leaned across the table and I looked at him and I said, well, sir, if you would get your ass out of the rear and start to lead this place from the front, you would probably have your morale go up.
Mm-hmm.
And the look on his face, and I said, I told you in the beginning, don't ask me if you don't want the answer. But the reality of the situation is you're not leading by example. You're not leading from the front. I equate it to parents with children. If parents are telling children how to behave and things to do and not do, but the kids are seeing their parents continuously doing the complete opposite, and I don't mean things you can do as an adult that you can't do as a child, but moral things, things of value, it sends great chaos and confusion about what is right and what is wrong.
In essence, what you're saying is there are those that talk the ethical talk but do not walk the ethical walk.
And they're quick to discipline their guys for things that either they have done or would do, and it just leads to great conflict for officers, not to mention anger, and anger and frustration.
Right. Now, you know, we have seen, you know, a tremendous shift in the political landscape and sociological landscape when it comes to law enforcement over the last few years. How has that change affected the law enforcement community as you have seen?
Well, you know, one of the things that bothers me, and it's going to be interesting to see over the next few months if Dallas and Baton Rouge have somewhat changed this, but I've had agencies actually call me and say, we want to bring you in, but you have to change the name of your course.
What?
And I go, what do you mean? And they said, we do not allow the word warrior to be used in our academy.
Are you kidding me?
They want me to call them peacekeepers and guardians. And I said, one of them I actually got into kind of a debate with. And I said, sir, let me explain something to you. I said, police officers go into this line of work because they have that guardian personality and value system within them. I don't have to teach them that. But the warrior mindset of this is something that you have to foster and grow and promote. And I said, words have power. A warrior can be a peacekeeper and a guardian, but rarely are a peacekeeper and a guardian a warrior unless they're trained to be one. But they want this politically correct, kinder, gentler approach. But you know what? In Dallas that day and that night, those were warriors fighting that battle that they were when they were being sniped from that garage. Those weren't just peacekeepers and guardians. And I think it's important for them to understand. Dave Grossman always says words have power, and they do. And that's one of the biggest changes I've seen in the 25 years that I've been teaching and been working with law enforcement, is this concept that we can't even call a warrior, because somehow that makes them violent, or I don't really understand it.
Well, this is part of the political environment here. This was started by President Obama,
yes,
with his softer policing approach, and then that organization called PERF, Police Executive Research Forum, which, yes, is in essence a political arm of the Obama administration, came,
yes,
out with that 21st century policing garbage. That,
yes,
is now infecting police agencies through their chiefs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the saddest statements as a mother of a Marine and someone going into law enforcement, I was talking with a group the other day and I said, my biggest fear is not my son being killed in the line of duty. I believe I could live with that easier than him having to go to prison for doing his job.
Exactly. And we are seeing that. I mean, we are,
yes,
literally seeing that type of inequity taking place. And that is demoralizing law enforcement officers all over the country, which, of course, then affects the mental health.
Yes.
Yesterday, I was speaking to a large police organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked this question. I said, by show of hands, is there anyone in this room that feels they are the same person today that they were when they entered law enforcement? And virtually not one person raised their hand. And that's very telling.
It is. But you know what I wish you would ask them next? How many of you feel that it has changed you for the better?
You know, that's something that I will do. That's a very interesting comment that you just made. And I should have done that.
We have these conversations in these trainings that we do. And, you know, I have some who'll go, yes, isn't it changed me? But it did change me for the better. Now, that's probably not the majority. But it's kind of nice for the majority to hear someone say, yes, it has changed me for the better. It can be for the better. You know, I think it's just like with the word stress, we all assume all too often that that word is negative. But the reality is stress in this industry can help people stay alive. It's what activates the adrenal gland. It's what brings on fight or flight. And people just always presume that change is bad, but not necessarily. So it'd be interesting, because I've never asked that continuously through my classes, but if that's something that you bring up, it'd be really interesting to see how many you have say it has changed them or changing them for the better.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I like that concept, because when I do my presentations, one of the things that we talk about is post-traumatic stress growth, and mm-hmm. how, you know, everyone that enters policing views the challenges differently, and it will change you as a person. But because you are exposed to so much, you are literally a witness to the great scheme of life, and it can create wonderful emotional opportunities for spiritual growth.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think this is another area. Yeah, you and I need to teach a class together, because I think we could play off of each other with our information quite well. You know, one of the other courses that I teach that I'm very surprised that departments are not jumping on it left and right, but it's a 4-hour course, and we call it Why Good Cops Make, quote, bad, close quote, decisions. And it's teaching supervisors to begin to notice changes in their people. And we want them to pick up on any negative changes when it's in the episodic stages early on.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't pick up on it in those stages, it then goes to chronic, where you wind up having to discipline or terminate.
Right, right. You know, that is really an interesting topic, because as a police supervisor, generally speaking, a sergeant, they are in the best position to be able to observe those changes and also influence changes for the positive. But
Absolutely.
But this is where courage and leadership takes place, because it's difficult for a sergeant, especially in a small department where they're working with people that they have known for many, many years, to take that role and use it in the manner in which it should be used, because they're afraid of being as stripe heavy.
Yes. Yes. Well, and they're also, you know, I've always said, of course, back when I first started, we had a lot more corporals. Don't really see a lot of corporals. Usually your sergeants now are your first line of defense, so to speak. But they aren't one of the guys, but they're not really the higher up either. So they're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place of, you know, who am I backing here? And I continue to tell them, you better be backing your people, because those are the people who are going to make you look really good or make you look really bad. And even if they just identify and pull that person in and say, hey, you know, I'm a little concerned about you. Here's a number. Here's a place you can call. Here's a Facebook page. You know, they can call us anytime, 24/7. We're available. We have toll-free numbers. We have stress coaches all over the country. We have two in Canada. And one of the things that we're excited about at Under the Shield is I hate to use the word targeting in this environment, but we are targeting the retired military, retired law enforcement, fire, EMS to come on and to be stress coaches. Because first of all, they're our most valuable resource, and we have all this money and time and training and experience invested in them, and then we let them just go sit at home.
No, you're right. That's very good. I like that. I like that concept.
And that's who we need. And, you know, they can do it from their cell phone sitting in the beach in Belize for all I care. But they can speak the language and be able to help people way above me. I was married to law enforcement, and I've got a lot of experience in it. The guys will tell you it's kind of scary how much Susan understands us when she's never been a cop. I tell them I read their minds. But if we can get these retired people involved, even on a limited basis, there are three characteristics in law enforcement. It's funny, I can walk into an academy and I can kind of tell you who's not going to be there working in law enforcement in 5 years. They are adrenaline junkies. They have attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. which is a real plus, and their caregivers. And the internal conflict, that's the other thing we talk about in our training, and the guys go, nobody ever talked about the internal conflict of doing this job. And I said, for the adrenaline junkie to be fed, something bad has to be happening to someone, which is in direct conflict with the caregiver.
Interesting. Yeah, very good.
And when you begin to identify these things, they're looking and they're going, that makes sense to me. But, you know, nobody wants to be Sheriff Taylor in Mayberry when they first come out of the academy, but put them in this job now, 10 years, and they probably would be begging to go do it.
That's right.
Where it used to be 15 to 20 years before you hit that retired on active duty.
Yeah.
But that internal conflict has to be identified, and people have to understand why they're feeling like they're feeling.
How can my listeners who are involved in law enforcement or their families, how can they reach out to you?
Okay, we have a website. It's undertheshield.com. Or they can call our toll-free number, which is 855-889-2348. It's also on the website. They can find us on Under the Shield Foundation on Facebook. We also have another kind of a unique thing for spouses and parents. It's called Partners in Crime on Facebook. There's a page and there's a closed group. We vet everybody who comes into that closed group, but we encourage them to join us. And the officers can join us also. But it's a safe place for families to come, talk about their concerns, their fears. We laugh a lot. A lot of great stuff going on in that closed group. And they can email us. Our email information is all over our website also. But we just ask them, please reach out. They don't have to give us their name. They can call at 1 o'clock in the morning. We don't care. We are here to help them any way that we can. We are a nonprofit, Randy. We're a 501c3. One of the things we're doing right now also is we're trying to get businesses to partner with us to provide these services. Because with everything going on, I tell businesses all the time, without police in our cities, deputies in our counties, and troopers on our highways, there's not a business in this country that can open.
Amen.
Fire department won't even come out. Look at Baltimore and Ferguson. If the police aren't there, they're not coming, nor should they. So we really need, and it's twofold. One thing is that we give them decals they can put on their businesses that say, we support you. And law enforcement needs to be seeing that. Families need to be seeing that right now. And then the other thing is it helps to provide these services because we don't like having to charge anybody for this.
Gotcha.
We do as much for free as we can, but please reach out to us. Families, reach out to us because that's what we're here for, and we can guarantee you confidentiality will be maintained. There's no exception to that.
Well, Susan Simmons of the Under the Shield, really thank you for being part of us today, and thank you so much for being on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Thank you, Randy, so much for having me.
This is Police Story, the real stories from those behind the badge.
Each week on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, I do what's called Police Story, where I read a story written by an active duty, retired, or former police officer. Today, taken from my book, True Blue, to Protect and Serve, a story written by a sworn officer from the Waverly Police Department in New York, David Decay. It's called Just Another Car Stop. I'm 39 years old. I'm married, have 3 children, and live in a small village called Waverly, New York, which is located in the southern tier of the New York State. I am employed by the Village of Waverly Police Department, a 10-officer department. I have about 18 years on the job now. Waverly, with a population of just 4,000, is generally pretty quiet. It's a nice place to live and not as dangerous as some of the bigger towns and cities, usually. But being a police officer is always potentially dangerous. You can never get careless or sloppy. It all started on September 18th, 2000. I had worked a day shift from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. I normally work the evening shift, but I had switched shifts with another officer that day. I started my day out patrolling and following up with investigations. Nothing too complicated. I was enjoying the nice sunny day and Indian summer, looking forward to the beginning of a week's vacation after my shift ended. It was 3 p.m., just an hour before my shift ended, just an hour until I could kick back and relax. The first thing I was going to do was take a seat in the backyard, open a beer, think about how I was going to spend the next 7 days. In the middle of this pleasant reverie, I observed a male subject that I knew was driving on a suspended driver's license. It wasn't much of a big deal, really. I followed him, pulled alongside, and waved to him to pull over to the curb. Maybe I could get this over with quickly and get on home. He looked at me with a wild expression on his face and began to slow up. Suddenly, he screamed a curse and hit the gas, and the pursuit started. I can tell you now I was pretty surprised and pretty angry, too. I just knew right then that I could only get things more complicated, and it did. When the pursuit started, the fleeing suspect was going so fast he almost lost control of the car. He swerved into oncoming traffic and almost caused several head-on accidents. The suspect struck a curb, which blew out his right tire, but that hardly even slowed him down. By this time, a second officer from my department was behind me, and we continued the pursuit at increasingly reckless speeds for about 11 miles. During the pursuit, this idiot sped by several school buses that were letting children off, putting citizens and children in grave danger, and that got me steamed. Halfway through the pursuit, my chief terminated the pursuit. We had already identified the driver of the vehicle, and the risk of some innocent bystander getting killed was becoming too much of a risk. I disengaged my lights and siren, but I continued to follow the subject at a safe distance. I felt an obligation and my duty to follow the suspect and have him in constant sight until other patrol units arrived from other agencies. This guy didn't seem to care whether he was going to kill someone. I had stopped thinking about my vacation. I wanted this guy. As I was following the suspect, my backup officer was behind me most of the way. He stopped, however, to put out a couple of fires along the way, sparks from the suspect's car rim that had started grass fires along the road. I didn't think about how dangerous this jerk was. I didn't think about the fact I had no backup. The guy was dangerous. It was my job to stop him. The suspect sped into a highway construction site where there were numerous construction workers. At that time, I didn't think of us really realize that the road came to a dead end. When he saw he could go no further, and I was blocking the road behind him, he stopped his vehicle. He just sat there. His hands were on the wheel. He didn't seem to have a weapon, so I got out of my vehicle with my weapon drawn and ran up to the driver's side of the vehicle. I ordered him to get out of the car and get onto the ground, spread his arms out. He didn't even look at me. He put his vehicle in reverse and stepped on the gas, and the front end of the vehicle swung around and knocked me to the ground. I got up and the suspect drove directly at me. I couldn't get out of the way in time. He just came too fast. The suspect struck me head on. I flew up onto the hood with my weapon still in my hand. I yelled at him to stop. I had my weapon pointed at him through the windshield. When he began to speed up, I fired one round through the windshield. That's when I was thrown off the vehicle onto the ground. The son of a bitch turned and started to drive off, so I fired another round. I then realized that I had to call for help. Numerous construction workers were helping me to my feet. I didn't seem to be hurt too badly. Nothing was broken. I thought, frankly, I just wasn't concerned about myself. I wanted to nail this guy. I ran back to my patrol car and went after him again and found the vehicle had gone through some bushes and into a yard and stopped about 100 yards away. I ran up to the vehicle to find the suspect slumped over the driver's side. I pulled him out of the car, tried to provide medical treatment, and found that I had shot him through the center of his chest. He was dead. Shortly after that, other police agencies were arriving. I was transported to a local hospital to be treated for minor injuries and released that night. New York State Police did the investigation of my shooting, and later my case went to grand jury, where I was cleared of any wrongdoing and found justified in my shooting incident. Whether you live in a large city or a small town, anything can happen in this job. At any time, anything can happen. There's no such thing as a simple vehicle stop. Nothing about this job is ever simple. Ever. If you have a police story that you would like to have read on the air, send it to me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. Well, it's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. You'll find a whole host of shows and a lineup of great content back at americaoutloud.com.
End of watch.
Every week on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we have a section called Officer Down. Unfortunately, this week we have two names that we need to talk about. Two law enforcement officers who lost their lives in the line of duty this week. The first officer that was killed in the line of duty was Officer Kenny Motes, a police officer with the Maryville Police Department in Tennessee. Police Officer Kenny Motes was shot and killed after responding to a domestic violence call at a home near the intersection of Kerway Lane and Alcoa Trail at approximately 4 p.m. Patrol units had responded to the home earlier in the day for a domestic dispute. Patrol units were sent to the address a second time, and when another call was received by dispatchers stating that one of the subjects was now armed, Officer Motes and a second narcotics detective who happened to be in the area responded to assist the patrol units. Officer Motes was fired upon and lost his life. End of watch, August 25th, 2016. The second police officer who was killed in the line of duty was Navajo Division of Public Safety Tribal Police Officer Leander Frank. Officer Frank was killed in a head-on crash while responding to a call in Apache County, Arizona. He was traveling on Route 64 when a vehicle hit him head-on and he was killed instantly. Officer Leander Frank, end of watch, August 30th, 2016. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I'd like to hear your comments, and you can follow me on my Facebook page under Randy Sutton, Public Figure, Twitter at Lieutenant Randy Sutton, and we have an app at the America Out Loud Network, and I urge you to go on to that because we are now live streaming as well. So we will see you next week.